One of the most interesting questions which face any historian is to balance out how much the actions and the policies of any individual leader affect the course of history. When Anwar Sadat, some over 4 years ago, made that bold visit to Jerusalem, he reinforced the ideas current among many that the actions of individuals have great and grave consequences, and that he had, in fact, by this act, changed the course of history. He had broken through that wall, that intransigent wall of opposition, non-recognition, which had characterized all of the Arab states until the time. He had visited Israel, he had spoken to the Knesset, he had begun negotiations, and presumably now the path of peace would be unfolded. The question before us is whether this is in fact the case, whether this was an idiosyncratic act, the act of an individual man, a man of great courage, perhaps of vision, which will and has profoundly changed the course of history, or whether, in fact, this is an act of a careful and shrewd political figure who is responding to the perceived need of his nation, an act which in one way or another would have been carried on by any leader of Egypt in order to achieve some very special Egyptian ends. And now with the assassination of Sadat, just before Yom Kippur, this question becomes more than a theoretical issue. Because if Anwar Sadat's actions were in fact the kind of individual act by a leader which forever changes history, there's a grave danger that with his death, all the consequences of that action are erased, disappear. But if, interestingly, if his actions were less than the media turned them into, if they represented a calculation by a nationalist figure, a man of obvious courage and daring do, but nevertheless an Egyptian politician who was interested more in what we might call the peace dividend than in peace itself, then the consequences of his act, insofar as his party will continue to lead Egypt, will remain, and we might be more hopeful of the future. Interestingly, when we examine the biblical tradition, we discover that we are discouraged from ascribing great importance to the acts of individuals. Put not your trust in princes. Let not the wealthy man rejoice in his wealth. Let not the wise man rejoice in his wisdom. Let not the strong man rejoice in his strength. But let him who would rejoice, rejoice in this, that he knows and understands me. The biblical tradition sought to drive home the point that the individual acts of people are essentially inconsequential in the management of history. It is God who determines the course of events, God and not man. There was a king in the 6th century by the name of Josiah. During his reign, the two great empires of that part of the world, Babylonia and Egypt, competed for that narrow corridor between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean in which Israel flourished. And he had but one choice, really, to cast in his lot to make some alliance with either one or the other of the great powers, either Egypt or Babylonia. And when, as was the custom of his day, he consulted the prophet, in this case Jeremiah, the word of God comes back through Jeremiah, not to make alliances with either of the great powers, but to have confidence, patient confidence in God, to establish justice in the community, but not to trust in the arrangements, the treaties which diplomats make between countries. The great virtue in biblical times is bitachon, steadfast confidence in God and God's beneficent control. And so we find very little encouragement in the biblical tradition for any view of the consequentiality of great men in the course of history. And we look down into more modern times, the most recent and most developed of all of the theories of history is, of course, the Marxist one. And Marxist historians insist that the actions of men are really of little consequence, that no man can stay the economic development of the class wars and ultimately the unfolding of the mass society, the dictatorship of the proletariat. You can change by an action here or there the timing of the inevitable dialectic of history. But inevitably it will unfold, it will unroll. The basic facts of history are not the actions, the will, the policies of individuals who ultimately only relate and affect and put forward the concerns of their class, but the economic and social realities of the time, and these cannot be gainsaid. Now, when we look into our own souls, I think it's true that in the more secular and humanist centers of the West, among most of us, there is a general feeling that what we do is of consequence. One of the, whenever a man or woman places themselves before us for election to high office, they tell us that they seek this office in order to put into effect this or that plan, program, which we presumably share with them. But the very fact that they come before us for our votes suggests that if they get too far out of phase with us, with our interests, we will not vote for them the next time and they will fail of re-election. And we certainly know that if the entrenched administrators of the society are out of phase with a particular program, no man, whatever his power, can really make it effective. In our very complex and integrated society, it's simply not true that any one man, whatever his vision, can markedly change the course of history. Now, of course, if we were all wise and all humble and all unselfish and all committed to all the good things of the world, we could, in fact, achieve a gracious and stable and peaceful society. But we're full of contradictions and we're full of appetites and we're full of greeds, and that's a vision which is simply not the case. Now, I'm not a determinist. I do believe that in small ways we do affect history. I do believe that class and economic realities are not the only realities which can be considered and must be considered when one understands the flow of time. But I also believe that we tend, because of the way in which reporting is done, the way in which history is taught, far to put too much emphasis on individual acts, and not to look at the act itself, but rather to fail to look at the causes, at the reasons for the action which was taken. Now, when we do, we often discover that what seems to be an act of great courage is really simply the catalyzing of a whole series of pressures of interest which have been roiling just below the surface, which suddenly one comes to appreciate when one sees a leader riding essentially on the shoulders of his population, leading them in the sense that he opens up for them a way to express their needs and to fulfill their purposes which had not been in place before. And that, I would suggest to you, is exactly what Anwar Sadat succeeded to do. Anwar Sadat won and the Nobel Prize for Peace. He is considered throughout the West and in large segments of the Jewish community to be a man who gave his life for the cause of peace. I mean in no way to derogate his courage or his derring do, or even his sense of the heroic, to suggest that he was simply, and that's saying a great deal, a convinced Egyptian patriot who set out not to achieve peace so much as to achieve some very specific goals which were important to him and to the class which he represents and presumably to Egypt. And I find comfort in that. Although as an aside, I must say that I find myself ill at ease with the reactions of many within our own community at the assassination of Sadat. One of you told me that during Yom Kippur services, a lady was sitting just in front of you, and she was complaining throughout my lecture about when I spoke of vows and repentance and the Yom Kippur theme that I wasn't giving a eulogy for Sadat. And I know that there were a number of congregations in which Sadat's name was included in the Kaddish list at the end of the service. And I know that there were a number of religious schools in which the children were encouraged to write simple little pious epithets for Sadat, praising him for his quality. But I would remind you that just 8 years ago, Anwar Sadat launched a war to destroy the state of Israel. And I would remind you that there are hundreds of homes in Israel in which there are widows and there are orphans because of that war. I'd remind you that Sadat was not a saint, but a soldier. He was not a visionary, but he was a man who at one time had been friendly with Nazi ideologies. He was a complex political figure whose interests at one moment in time happened to seem to coincide with some desperate hopes held by many within our community, by all of us within our community. And we began to see him as something far more than he was, and I think he began to see himself as something far more than he was in his last years. But he was not a saint, he was a soldier. He was not a visionary so much as an able and imaginative politician. And he was a man who, at least in the foreign policy area, was able to achieve because of his derring do. He had something of Errol Flynn about him. Because of his derring do, he was able to put Israel into a position where Israel had to agree, I think, to more concessions than they might have agreed if the negotiations, which any Egyptian government at the time, I think, would have undertaken, had in fact been undertaken in a more familiar, pedestrian, plodding kind of way. Now, what was Sadat's concern 5 years ago? You'll recall that despite his lightning attack on Israel in 1973, and despite the high cost in lives that Israel had to pay, Israel had won the war. Israel was occupying the east bank of the Suez Canal and all of the Sinai. You'll recall that shortly after the 1973 war, representing as he did the mercantile, the merchant classes of Egypt, the people who were part of what we call a modern technological state, Sadat threw out the Russians who had up to this time supplied the Egyptian army, built the Aswan Dam, trained the Egyptians in the use of sophisticated equipment, and this is the reason they were thrown out, engaged in subversion against the class interests which Mr. Sadat represents. For the Russians had gone to the poor and the impoverished and the masses, and they sent out their agents, and they were fomenting Nasserite kinds of activity among the desperately poor of that country. And having thrown out the Russians, Mr. Sadat had an obsolescent military machine. He had an officer corps which was not fully trained in the management of the equipment that they had or the organization of modern warfare. He had a desperate need to bring in fresh capital. And since his capital, the capital of the Eastern Bloc was denied to him, the only place he could turn was to Europe and to the West. He had a new enemy. A new enemy on his western front rather than on his eastern front. He had Muammar Gaddafi to deal with. And he saw developing around his country a plan to essentially surround Egypt and its satellite, the Sudan, as Gaddafi was moving into Uganda and Chad, and there were radical forces in Eritrea and in Ethiopia. And so everything at the time led the leadership of Egypt to recognize that they had to find a way to open up Egypt in terms of Western investment, to find in the West a new source of fairly cheap rearmament because they had driven away their major source of arms. They had to find an excuse, a reason to move their forces from East to West, and the only way they could do this was by going through Jerusalem. And so we find Sadat in a moment of brilliant daring, moving into Jerusalem, and we find that whole scenario, which a year and a half later led to Camp David, come into effect. Now, the peace dividend was achieved. The Israelis had what they said they wanted, an Arab state that would deal with them, the major confrontation state negotiating with them. And because there was this breakthrough, Mr. Begin was in a position where he had to give in. And he gave back, in stages, an agreement to remove himself and Israel from all of the Sinai, from its minerals and from its oil, from the coastline of the Gulf of Aqaba, from Sharm el-Sheikh, from all of the strategic and resource values of the Sinai. Egypt gained not only the Sinai, they gained the use of the Suez Canal, they gained the interest of the military-industrial establishments of Europe and of the West. Investments began to pour into Egypt. Oil was found in some degree, not only in the Sinai, but in Egypt. New plants were established. The United States proved its willingness to take up where Russia had removed herself. And whereas in 1976, before Jerusalem, Egypt was receiving less than $200 million a year in aid from the United States, by last year she was receiving over $2.5 billion in military aid alone. The policy which Sadat manifested, which was that of his class and his group in Egypt, was brilliantly achieved by the Camp David agreements. The peace dividend, it was and is real. And insofar as the peace dividend has not yet fully been realized, that is, the scheduling of the third and final movement of Israeli forces out of the Sinai is not scheduled to take place till April of 1982, you can be sure that Hosni Mubarak, Anwar Sadat's chosen successor, will continue the so-called peace policies, the pro-Camp David policies of his predecessor. Now, what I'm suggesting to you this morning is that Hosni Mubarak, who represents the exact same groups within the Egyptian political scheme, as did Anwar Sadat, he will continue what were, in effect, the policies of Anwar Sadat. Egypt after Sadat is exactly as Egypt was with Sadat. There are no changes, but there is one change, and it would have become as real whether Sadat had remained alive or whether Mubarak had, as now, taken his place. And that is that Egyptian policy has gained the peace dividend and will have gained it fully by April of next year. The other issues of Camp David, the West Bank, East Jerusalem, these are not Egyptian issues. These may be pan-Arab issues, but they're not uniquely Egyptian issues. And once April comes around, whether Sadat was still with us or Mubarak, as is now the case, you will find that the Egyptian policies would inevitably change because they now move to a new set of concerns. And these new set of concerns are essentially domestic and military, as all national purposes are. The threat on the West remains alive and strong. We have 8,000 American men in military maneuvers in the western desert of Egypt right this moment because of that threat. It's a real threat. And as long as it exists as a real threat, I think Israel can rest secure that the Egyptians are not going to contemplate new military actions as in 56 and 67 and 73 against Israel. But I think it's also fair to say that anyone who were sitting in the seats of power in Egypt once April rolls around would begin to move away from the concerns with Camp David because they have achieved all that Camp David could do for them. And they would now try and put themselves back into context in the southern tier of the Arab states where there is the oil and the so-called moderation that Washington talks so much about, which means simply a willingness to deal with the banks and the big oil companies of the West. And as long as that is, in fact, the need, because that will bring in banking, money, commerce, goods, allow trade, export, and so on, do all the things that the Egyptian economy requires, one can be sure that whether Sadat were alive or not, whereas he is not, Egypt would move now in a different direction, and the major concerns of Egypt would no longer be her relationship with Mr. Begin and with Israel. And so the search for peace, that is, those elements of the Camp David Agreement, which were never really that carefully spelled out of the open door, what would happen when we went beyond the exchange of ambassadors, will probably never be fully explored, at least not in the immediate future. And so it seems to me clear that the idea of major trade between Israel and Egypt is something which will quickly fall into desuetude. There'll be all kinds of reasons discovered in Cairo to delay, not to do. No great action will be taken of a negative nature, but Egypt will slowly but surely reposition herself within the world of which she is a part and the world whose investments and whose interests are so important to her. Sadat would have done the same thing. Because as I suggested to you, his goal was not peace so much as the peace dividend. And now he needs to, whoever's in charge of Egypt needs to extend that dividend. Egypt after Sadat is exactly as Egypt before Sadat. A country which is westernized to a very large degree, more than any other country except Israel in the Middle East. A country which is poor, as almost all the countries in the Middle East are, despite the export of 400,000 barrels of oil a day, despite the tolls of the Suez Canal, which has now been long since been opened, is being dredged to admit the widest and longest oil ships of the world. Egypt is a country the size of Texas and New Mexico, but only about 6% of Egypt is arable. Egypt is a country which has the largest number of college graduates in the Middle East. About 16% of every age cohort has for the last several generations gone to college. But Egypt cannot provide employment for these. And so besides the oil and besides the canal, one of the major sources of income for Egypt has been the remittance of wages of the 2.5 million Egyptians who work elsewhere in the Arab world. Egypt, like most of the world, is suffering inflation. It's running between 25 and 30% a year. Egypt is suffering, as is most of the world, an increase of the separation between the haves and the have-nots. One of the truths about Sadat's leadership of Egypt is that he represented the interests of the upper classes, of the educated classes. One of the things I think which surprised the West is that when Sadat was assassinated, there was very little of that typical enthusiastic wailing, which is typical of an Arab funeral. The Egyptians, when Nasser died, poured out in the streets and remained in the streets for the 40 days of mourning. When Sadat died, they went to their dinner parties the same night. There was a wonderful little cartoon in the Jerusalem Post several weeks ago. It's called Dry Bones. And it showed a man, an Israeli, sitting in front of a television set. And the announcer is saying, 80,000 people have come into Anwar Sadat Square to praise and eulogize Egypt's fallen leader. And in the next box, you see this man talking to himself. He's saying, I knew the Egyptians wouldn't remain silent forever. And in the next box, the television picks up again and says, the parade and eulogy was organized in Tel Aviv by Abi Natan. The Egyptians knew that Sadat had not resolved the problems which are uniquely and domestically Egypt. Sadat's policies were so appropriate to the West because, like the West, he believed in what we're now coming to call trickle-down economics. It's a word that's in bad repute in the United States, and it should be, and it's in bad repute in Egypt, and it should be. And that is, if only there's enough wealth made, if only the wealth get wealthy enough and have enough goods, somehow all of this will pass down to the society. And so while Sadat had his lovely home in his native village, where his father had been a sizable landlord, and while the upper classes of Egypt lived fairly well, the largely educated, underemployed classes of Egypt were suffering from inflation and were turning more and more to either radical economic and political ideologies or to reactionary Islamic policies. And it was a group of people committed to the Muslim Brotherhood, committed to the removal of these kinds of modernistic adjustments between Islam, Western ideas, and Western ideas that in fact assassinated Sadat. Sadat used to mock the women in their veils. He called them walking tents. But many in Egypt mock Jahan Sadat, his lovely wife, who has seemed so attractive to the West. She's a graduate of the university. She has a master's degree in library sciences. She dresses well with French and British couturiers. She talks gracefully and openly, but to many in the Arab world, to many of the men of the Arab world, this represents the greatest threat possible. The manumission of women, women's rights, equality of the sexes, and the transformation of all that they assume to be God-ordained, Quran-mandated, and therefore was desirable. Sadat was not able to bring up the lot of the bottom two-thirds of Egypt. And it was among those people that there was anger and frustration, and it is to those people that the more radical ideologies appealed and continue to appeal. So Sadat, who was a hero to the West because he seemed to be doing something which we needed desperately to arrange things between Israel and Egypt so the United States could be the friends of both, in his own country, was seen as more and more an aloof tyrant who was living the good life, whose friends were living the good life, but who was not that concerned with the average day-to-day needs of his own people. And though he was a devout Muslim, rather orthodox Muslim in his beliefs, he did not maintain the concerns, the way of life which in Israel the Torah true are trying to impose upon the whole society, as I spoke to you last week, and in Egypt the Muslim Brotherhood is trying to impose upon the whole society. And so there were dangerous rumblings and have been for some time. It's an unbalanced society. They've had to maintain major subsidies on basic commodities in order for the people to be able to have bread to live with, the food to live on, and some kind of housing over their head. Cairo has the worst housing stock of any major city in the world. And the subsidies were more and more costly. Inflation was more and more restrictive of what people had. And the society seemed to be going from bad to worse. And so it's not surprising if Hosni Mubarak's major concerns are not the concerns which are important to you and to me, peace in the Middle East. He doesn't want war, but he's got to find a way to raise up the standard of living that his own country, to bring more investment into a society, to find ways of sharing wealth more equitably. He's got to do that against the entrenched desires of the class which he supposedly represents. And his only way of doing it, or one of his only ways of doing it, is to attract the investment of those in the oil-rich countries who have every reason to want to see a strong Egypt allied in purpose with their own. So if I were Mr. Begin, sitting in Jerusalem, I would not expect a great deal from Hosni Mubarak, but then I would not have expected a great deal from Anwar Sadat. The future, as far as Israel is concerned, is that Egypt will become at best coldly distant. Egypt has no reason at this moment in time to want to engage in further military attack on Israel. But Egypt has also no reason to want to open up the borders and become Israel's one good, clear, and close friend in the Middle East. There's absolutely no political reason for Mubarak to take that step. And in that sense, those who are saying there must be a larger context than Camp David for peace in the Middle East are correct. They're saying it for the wrong reasons. But they're correct. If Israel is to have any kind of security, Jordan and Syria and Lebanon and the other confrontation states must somehow be brought in. But Mr. Begin gave away a great deal to Mr. Sadat, and there are very few bargaining chips left. If I were Mr. Begin, I think I would delay my removal from the rest of Sinai until I had somehow found a way to tie that removal in with whatever arrangements will ultimately have to be made about the West Bank. Egypt does not want to face the issues of the West Bank. If you read very carefully the statements of Sadat and Mubarak, though they say the West Bank must have autonomy, East Jerusalem must be the capital of an Arab community, they're also saying that we're only going to begin the process. The Palestinians must ultimately carry out their own purposes. They want to get away from it. It's a thorny, difficult issue. They want no part of the fallout from it. But Israel is going to have to face that issue. And the question is really whether it's prepared to dig in its heels now when Egypt does not yet have all it wants, and whether it perhaps can keep Egypt partially on its side and in the eyes of the world, continue to be the parasite nation it is, or whether it wants to seem to carry on the spirit of Camp David. It's made such a fetish of Camp David that it can't pull back from that, and then it will have to face the issues of the West Bank and Jerusalem without really anything to give up. It's not going to be easy. But then giving up the last third of the Sinai will not be easy, because it means not only giving up the coastline of the Gulf of Aqaba and that little bottleneck at Sharm el-Sheikh, which alone allows shipping in and out of Eilat and Aqaba, but it means giving up a number of settlements, of which the most important is Yamit, which have been established in the Sinai by Israelis and are now largely populated by the most belligerent, militant Greater Israel people you can imagine, who are prepared to defy their own government. To pull back in April at this point will mean Begin will have to have the will to send in the troops to remove forcibly his own people. And he is essentially sympathetic, I think, to those who have moved in and find that very difficult. It will ultimately pull down his coalition. So there are domestic reasons which it might suggest to Mr. Begin that this tying in of the third stage of removal, this moving away from Camp David, might be in Israel's benefit. Whether he will do that or not is problematic. But I see no other way out of the difficulty in which Israel is now boxed unless something of this kind is done. The greater danger, of course, is the ultimate instability of Egypt. The real question in the Middle East for Israel is whether or not Egypt and Saudi Arabia and the Persian states can remain as they are, so-called moderate states run by people who represent the investing classes, or whether they will ultimately become radicalized states as they represent the majority of the people, the poor, who form the population of each of these states, in which case they will obviously align themselves with the Eastern Bloc and the Soviet, and it will be very, very difficult for Israel to survive in that world. The United States is moving towards shoring up all of these so-called moderate states. And the problem here, of course, is that they seem moderate in terms of the economic interests of the West, but they are not moderate, for the most part, in terms of the survival interests of Israel. So I can't paint for you a pretty picture this morning. As far as Israel is concerned, Egypt after Sadat is no better or no worse than Egypt with Sadat. I think that's true. I think we cannot, at least expectations have been lowered. There was always that hope that somehow Begin and Sadat would embrace each other once again and everything would turn up right. No one thinks that Mubarak and Begin are going to embrace each other and somehow bring off another miracle. But the reality is not a pleasant one. And the future is full of danger and of concern. And clearly in the West there is growing impatience with the problem. Israel has become a problem to the West. Everyone accords to Israel the right to survive, but nobody wants to be concerned with how to guarantee to Israel the ability to survive. The West would like to erase Israel simply because it is a problem. One of the most fascinating and frightening little moments of the last few weeks was the visit of King Hussein to the State Department. He was taken into a room where he was supposed to hold a press conference, and some American member of the State Department, American official in the State Department, had put a map on the wall, which included the listing of every state in the Middle East except Israel. This is not in Jordan, mind you, but in the United States, and not in an oil company's executive office, but in the United States State Department. And when this was noticed by a reporter and the press attaché was asked about it, he had no explanation. He didn't know where it had come from. Well, I know where it had come from, and so do you. It had come out of the sensitivity of some foreign officer in the State Department to King Hussein's unwillingness to recognize the State of Israel. Now, Hussein has met with Israelis. He met with Abba Ibn before 67. He met with Dayan after 67. He knows very well that Israel exists. But if our own State Department has gotten to the point where they are so concerned with even the sensitivities, forget the political demands of Middle Eastern oil states and non-oil states, what does that mean in terms of the kind of support, or the kind of understanding that Israel can expect? Israel will have to rely, I'm afraid, in the next years on strength, on nerve, and on judgment. And I don't know, and I'm not convinced, that this present government has the strength of will or the judgment to carry on a deliberate and consistent policy. I think when the history of the last 8 or 9 years is written, though Mr. Sadat and Mr. Begin both won for themselves Nobel Peace Prizes, they will go down in history as men who, both of them, played a role in a drama in which Israel came out the loser, because Israel was not prepared to stand up against Sadat at that moment in time and say, we cannot give you everything back until other things have happened along the way. Begin made a classic political error, and there's going to be a price to be paid for it. What's for it then? Well, what's for it then is I hope to visit Egypt in January and to see for myself something of that country and its problems, its possibilities. What's for it then? Egypt is no longer a confrontation state in the sense that Israel must maintain a constant sense of military preparedness. She doesn't, at the moment, need to fear Egyptian military attack, and I can't imagine that in the next few years she will. But of course, as Egypt fits more and more back into the Arab world, who knows what time will hold. At this moment in time, Israel needs to delay. Israel needs to negotiate. Israel needs to create the conditions which permit negotiation. And I can only hope and pray that her diplomats and leaders will have the skill to find ways to create those conditions. Because I think it's a case where they and they alone will be able to achieve this. No one else shares their concerns. And if they fail to find ways to hold some cards when it comes to the negotiating table, then Israel will have to be prepared to accept what they say they will never accept, and that is a Palestinian state in the West Bank, some kind of joint sovereignty over Jerusalem, the return of Gaza, all the things with the Israelis of all parties say are policies and programs which are anathema to them. Sadat has died. The hope for peace did not die with him, because it was not born with him. It's the hope of people throughout the world. Will there be peace in the Middle East? You know, I've said to you time and again, alavai, but it's going to be a long time off. The Middle East has to go through any number of revolutions, any number of sorting out of priorities, of positions, of feelings. What's happening in the Middle East now is what's happening in part around the world, the resurgence of orthodoxies of all, medieval orthodoxies of all kinds. What's happening in the Middle East is what's happening throughout the rest of the world, and that is the growing demands of the masses, however illiterate and lacking ability they may be for their share of the opportunities of the world. What's happening in the Middle East, and what is not happening elsewhere in the West at least, is the emergence of a feudal society into a modern society. And when you take and overlay all of these crises, all of these convulsive changes in the society, you cannot expect stability. What you must accept is expect our countries, which will be moving radically from one program into another. What is needed is that old Jewish virtue with which I introduced this talk, bitachon, steadfast faith, confidence that despite all of the vagaries of change and of politics, God somehow is in control of history, and ultimately he has a place for our people. And ultimately, he will make a place for us in the future. Amen.